Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Before the MLS, before Messi, before Ronaldo, before the Premier League, there was Canalia. Giorgio Canalia, the most prolific goal scorer in the history of American soccer. Period. The ultimate goal hanger. He had an unbelievable knack for finding the back of the net and was a major reason why the New York Cosmos of the old NASL, North American Soccer League, would routinely draw over 70,000 fans a game at Giant Stadium. Next on Sports Forgotten Heroes, Giorgio Canalia.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to another podcast of Sports Forgotten Heroes. In just a moment, a terrific soccer historian will be joining us, Kartik Krishnayar, and he'll be here to talk about one of the most polarizing individuals in the history of soccer here in the U.S., Giorgio Canalia. Now, I'm quite sure there are a few of you out there who have heard of number 9 for the old New York Cosmos, but there are plenty who haven't. And that's a shame because he was, perhaps, the most feared striker in the history of the sport in America. So, why is he long forgotten when he actually didn't play that long ago? Well, that could be because the NASL, or North American Soccer League, folded up operations after the 1984 season. And we're going to get a little bit into the NASL as well. Of course, the NASL was our major professional soccer league before today's MLS. Teams played in New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland, Dallas, Chicago, and many smaller towns as well, such as Tulsa, Fort Lauderdale, Memphis, and elsewhere. And teams in today's MLS, like Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, and elsewhere, have carried on their NASL legacy by using the same team name as they did back in the days of the NASL. Just a reminder, you can follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter, at SportsFHeroes, look for our page on Facebook, or follow us on the web at SportsFH.com. Please drop us an email and let us know how we're doing or who you think we should do a show on, or give us a rating on iTunes. Also, don't forget that Sports Forgotten Heroes is sponsored by Audible. With Audible, you get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/sportsfh. What does that mean? Well, when you don't have time to sit and read or you're not listening to Sports Forgotten Heroes, there's great literature out there and terrific voice talent to bring it to you in such a unique way. In fact, there's almost 200,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And Audible is a great way to show your support for Sports Forgotten Heroes. Give it a try free at www.audibletrial.com/sportsfh. No obligation. You don't have to pay for a thing. You know, the Cosmos were the team in the NASL. The world's greatest players left their homes to come play in New York at a time when guys like Reggie Jackson and Billy Martin ruled the area. When the Giants and Jets, along with the Mets, Knicks, and Rangers, were down, the Cosmos were it, and leading the way was Giorgio Canalia. From the time he arrived in 1976 until he retired in 1983, he led the Cosmos to the championship game 5 times and came away with the win in 4 of those games. He led the league in scoring 5 times and once scored 7 goals in 1 game, Overall, he scored 193 goals in his eight seasons, 34 in 1978, and added 49 goals in the playoffs, including an incredible 18 in 1980 in just seven games. Just mind-boggling numbers. And now, here to tell us more about the incredible and sometimes intolerable Giorgio Chinaglia is Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, welcome back to Sports Forgotten Heroes. I am so glad you're back with us.
It's great to be back with you, Warren, and this is going to be a fun show.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and let's just get right into it. And we'll start with the NASL, the North American Soccer League. And, you know, it really was something back then, especially the Cosmos. I mean, every game that team played, it was an event, and boy, did they have the stars. They had Pelé, Franz Beckenbauer, Carlos Alberto, Stevie Hunt, Ricky Davis, so many. And, of course, they had Giorgio Chinaglia. And why don't we just start with that? Just how big were the Cosmos?
Off the charts big. They were, for a period of time, rivaling the New York Yankees in terms of just kind of media attention, the kind of sexiness around the team in town. And they were obviously also just the cosmopolitan nature of the team, the number of international stars they had. And this is important for people to realize that, say, well, now, obviously, you've got Real Madrid and Manchester United and Barcelona and whoever else, Manchester City, that have those sorts of squads. In those days, you couldn't assemble those sorts of squads in European domestic leagues. So the Cosmos were really the first kind of eclectic mix of international superstar talent in the world of international of club football. It was amazing.
Yeah, I remember going to the game. It was like it was an event, and they played at the old Giants Stadium,
yep.
And almost 80,000 people would fill. They would fill the stands for every game. So in terms of today's MLS, is there any team that can compare as far as popularity and excitement is concerned?
Well, I mean, the team that I guess people would cite now is Atlanta United, who are owned by Arthur Blank, who play in Mercedes-Benz Stadium. And I think there is a lot of excitement around that club, mm-hmm. but and they have a number of young Latin American stars. But the point I would make about them is that they are, because they're owned by Arthur Blank and they're playing in Mercedes-Benz Stadium, they're connected to the popularity of the Falcons, right? There's
mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, I think that's a great thing for that club. But the Cosmos were an independent entity that at the time were as popular in some respects as the Giants and the Jets, if not more popular. That wasn't necessarily a good era of New York mm-hmm. tackle football or mm-hmm. New York American football. So the Cosmos were there at the right time. The thing that I've discovered, because I've worked for the new NASL as the communications director, and we brought the Cosmos back, and the Cosmos have played the last few seasons. The thing I just didn't realize were how many fans of the Cosmos still were around, who have turned back towards American sports, or largely Yankees fans, or fans of the New York Giants, and then they watch international club football. They'll watch the Premier League. They'll be watching Manchester United or Arsenal, but they were disconnected from the American game, including MLS. But they have this reverence for the Cosmos, and so I think a lot of the roots of fandom, because now we know the English Premier League in this country is more popular than mm-hmm. soccer. Mm-hmm. NBC shows those games every week, whereas you have to search and search to find MLS games on your channel,
right.
On your TV. The genesis of the Premier League being popular in this country was the Cosmos, and. The thing I would also say is that the Cosmos, like the Dallas Cowboys, like the Yankees, right? The Yankees are the most obvious example. And like maybe the Celtics at times in history have been this really hated team that when they went on the road, it drew bigger crowds than you get normally in those cities or those stadiums, just because people went to cheer against the Cosmos, and more specifically, and I know we're going to get to the subject, Giorgio Canali.
What about the Cosmos style of play, their caliber of play? Could those Cosmo teams compete with the teams that play in the MLS today? Would the Cosmos contend for an MLS Cup?
Yeah, they would. I mean, I think the one issue would be fitness, because people, the level of fitness and the level of the regimen of guys being able to play for 90 minutes and play at a high pace is much higher now because of sports science, because of diet. The thing about the Cosmos, part of what made the Cosmos so legendary was the amount of partying that went on by the Cosmos players and the celebrity culture around it, and going to these nightclubs in New York, these famous nightclubs, our listeners probably know. I keep blocking out on the names. Club
Studio 54.
Studio 54. Yeah. In fact, Phil Mushnick, the New York, a longtime New York Post writer, he had said once in a documentary I watched that he went to Club 54 and they were going to throw him out. He's a newspaper writer. All he had to say was, "I'm with the Cosmos," because he was covering the Cosmos beat. The place was his canteen.
Unreal. Why do you think players from around the world wanted to come and play for the Cosmos? And we're not just talking any old players. We're talking the greatest players.
Yeah, because I think that there was certainly a missionary task of trying to make soccer a popular sport in the United States. And then there was the lifestyle of New York. And there was also just, I think at that time, a feeling that if you could have success in America, you could have success anywhere. We didn't have the internet then. We didn't have games being via satellite from all over the world. I mean, even in those days, I remember it would be an arduous task to get any football, soccer matches from abroad. Even the British Open, Wimbledon, those sorts of things you would get limited coverage of that because of the limitations of the time. And so it was this zeal, this missionary task for a lot of the players. And then there was also the reality that at the time you didn't have the European Union. So you didn't have what has developed due to the European Union's Bosman ruling, which allowed essentially free agency within the European Union for soccer players. So if your contract runs out now with, let's say you're playing for Manchester City, your contract runs out, Arsenal can sign you on a free, or Bayern Munich can sign you for free. In those days, much like the NFL, remember, this was an issue in the NFL until the early 90s. And that's around the time the Bosman ruling came down for soccer in Europe. So around the same time, outside of Major League Baseball, all of these sports in the world, NFL, NBA, prior to the Larry Bird rule in the NBA, European soccer, you were the property of the club that you played for.
Right.
So if your contract expires, they had exclusive rights to renegotiate with you. So you couldn't move to another team in that league. So basically, a lot of guys ended up in the U.S. for that reason. Now, there's a crazy player market in Europe, a market that this is probably a topic for another day, but a player market so intoxicated by money and agents' fees that I think it'll crash at some point. There's just too much money in European soccer. But at the time, there wasn't. So a lot of players came here.
Interesting. So now the million-dollar question. All these great players came here, and it wasn't just to the Cosmos. I mean, you know, they were spread around the entire league. So the million-dollar question, how was it that the NASL could not capitalize on the success of the Cosmos and sustain a major soccer league here?
I think there are a couple answers to this question. One is overexpansion. They went into markets that they had a core of some very strong clubs. So the Cosmos were strong. Tampa Bay Rowdies were very strong. Minnesota Kicks were very strong. They had Seattle, Portland, Vancouver. Those three are now strong in MLS, right? Same Pacific Northwest has always had a Flanders for soccer. Fort Lauderdale was a strong club. Dallas tornado at times. Atlanta always had strong clubs, but then they went into places like Memphis and Hartford and the Boston team. Tulsa. Well, Tulsa was okay.
Yeah,
that was actually they actually drew okay, but they went into a number of markets where they failed pretty quickly. Memphis, Jacksonville, the Colorado. They constantly would go into Colorado and fail. Philadelphia, they failed multiple times, and they were just unable to have the discipline to corral the league and say, okay, let's do this slowly. We have 12 or 14 solid clubs. We don't need to expand to 24, 28 like the NFL had 28 teams at the time. We don't need to expand to that. The second factor was the U.S. not getting the 1986 World Cup and then going to Mexico instead. It was at that point that the league kind of just completely lost all momentum. The thought was, and of course, the U.S. ended up hosting the World Cup in 1994 and is bidding to host it again in 2026. But had the World Cup come to the U.S. in 1986, NASL would have gained the momentum it needed. It would still be in existence today. But that was a critical decision by FIFA to go to Mexico instead of the United States. And at that point, because the U.S. didn't get the World Cup, a lot of the people who were investing in soccer in the U.S. thought, okay, this is a dead end, and got out. Now, of course, there were some guys – like Lamar Hunt, who of course owned the Kansas City Chiefs, and actually was the inspiration behind the Super Bowl. Lamar Hunt, who owned the Dallas Tornado, who he gave up at that point, but he still kept his interest in soccer and MLS's existence today. Really, the existence of professional soccer in the United States has a lot to do with Lamar Hunt. After the NASL folding, deciding, you know what, I'm going to give this another go. That's why the U.S. Open Cup trophy is called the Lamar, or the U.S. Open Cup is now called the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup in honor of him. He's now seen as, I think the founding father of American professional soccer, even though a lot of it predated him, but it had collapsed.
Oh, interesting.
As well as the AFL, as well as the Super Bowl, as well as the Chiefs, which were the Dallas Texans originally. And interestingly enough, the WTA tennis tour. So, Mr. Hunt was all over sports.
Really interesting. Okay, so now Giorgio Chinaglia. All right, let's do it this way. For soccer fans who have never heard of him, and I would find that hard to believe, but for soccer fans who have never heard of him, who have forgotten about him, remind us. Who was Giorgio Chinaglia, and just how great a goal scorer was he?
So he was a Italian Welsh striker who was born in Italy, grew up in Wales, started with Swansea, which is a club I think everybody knows, every soccer fan knows. Weren't a big club then, but they're a Welsh club, obviously now in the Premier League, and he then went back to Italy, was an incredible goal scorer for Lazio, which is one of the two big clubs in Rome, the capital, but was also he was a colorful character.
Colorful is a good word.
Yeah, for lack of a better term. So he wore out his welcome at Lazio. He wore out his welcome with the Italian national team, got kicked off the national team. He had married an American in 1970 when he was playing for Lazio, an American servicewoman, not an American servicewoman, a daughter of an American serviceman who was growing up, who was stationed in Italy and had grown up in Italy. So he was able to come to the United States. And as Clive Toy, the former commissioner of the NASL and founder of the New York Cosmos, said, Chinaglia actually ended up being the easiest big name signing an American club ever made. I mean, they had to fight to get Pelé. They had to fight to get Beckenbauer. Even now, the Galaxy, just in the last here in 2018, had to fight off suitors to get Zlatan.
Right, because Giorgio basically went to Clive and said, either I'm going to play for the Cosmos or I'd like to purchase my own team. And he sort of like had to weigh the options of what to do. And he says, you know what? I'll just sign with the Cosmos. Give me a contract.
Right, because he had no other options, because it may be tough for younger people to understand this, but in that era, you could not be a individual, a personality, a colorful character in team sports. So the guys who were colorful and acted out in basketball ended up in the ABA, right? They didn't, NBA teams didn't sign them or didn't encourage the signing of them. The NFL was called has been called the no fun league at all. I mean, they limited self-expression. A lot of soccer clubs were the same way. Major League Baseball too, although baseball I think had some colorful characters that they tried to rein in, but especially in that era, the 1970s. But Canalia was a guy that most football clubs, I think there was collusion and conspiring throughout Europe. We're not going to sign this guy. We're not going to touch this guy. He's a bad egg. So, this is why the great Georgie Best, who maybe we'll talk about sometime in the future.
Sure.
The great 30 for 30 documentary on.
Yep.
If you
I saw that.
Like me. Yeah, if like me, you've spent the $4.99 on ESPN Plus already, you can probably get it on demand, because that's, I guess, one perk of ESPN Plus is that they're giving you all the 30 for 30s. But if you haven't seen it, recommend the Georgie Best one. Georgie Best was the same kind of character, and that's why he floated around from team to team, and he ended up in the U.S. with Fort Lauderdale and San Jose as well. But that was the genesis of Canalia. It was the easiest signing they could make, because no one in Europe wanted a guy that was this outspoken.
Mm. When I think of him, I think of the word striker. I mean, I think there are few, very few, that were as hungry to score goals as he was. What do you think drove him? Take me, if you can, inside his mindset. Was he a goal hanger?
Yeah, he was a poacher, for lack of a better term. He knew how to position himself to pick up all the scraps, you know, like a vulture in wildlife, right? I mean, he knew where reflexively the ball would bounce, where to find space, where not to be marked. And he didn't score pretty goals. He scored these just scrappy goals where the ball would bounce around. He scored some pretty goals too, but don't get me wrong, but where the balls would bounce around, ball would bounce around in the box. He would have this uncanny sense of positioning to put it home and slot it home for a goal. He also, I think, had this insatiable desire for attention.
Uh-huh.
So when he scored a goal, you know, right away, stick his hands up, you know, and play to the crowd. It was at Giant Stadium. It was playing
Bedlam
to the crowd. Yeah. It was Bedlam, and then he would even be looking at the director's box. If it were in an opposing team stadium, it would be to taunt the fans. And in a lot of cases, this is again the 1970s and early 1980s, people would throw things on the pitch. They would try and pelt things at him. I was at a game as a kid when I was a ball boy at Lockhart Stadium in Fort Lauderdale, when Fort Lauderdale played the Cosmos, and Fort Lauderdale had some big stars, and then it could be as George Best had just left. But there were Gerd Müller, who at the time was the all-time leading goal scorer in European Champions League competition, has just been surpassed by Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi in the last few years. But Canalia was still the attraction. I mean, you have all these legends of world football, but it wasn't he was great, and he was a great goal scorer, but it was his demonstrative behavior. You know, he'd be in the face of the officials anytime another Cosmos player didn't pass the ball to him, his hands went out. He was just one of those guys. And in sporting culture, we have more and more of those players now. But at the time, you had very few in soccer, very few in the NFL, very few in the guys in the NFL like that all ended up on the Raiders because there seems to be, again, the collusion that you don't want to sign these guys. And Al Davis was willing to, but it really, I mean, sports at the time, it was very conservative and doctrinaire and, you know, you behave yourself. Canalia wasn't like that.
I don't think any U.S. soccer fan had ever seen anything like Canalia before or since. I mean, when it came to scoring goals, this guy was incredible. I mean, twice, Giorgio Canalia scored as many as 7 goals in one game. Think about that. think about that for a second. 7 goals in 1 game, and one was in a playoff game against the Tulsa Roughnecks, and I think the other came in an indoor soccer game. But 7 goals in 1 game. How do you do that?
I don't know how you do that. I mean, I saw a game in 2009 in London where Jermaine Defoe scored 5 goals for Tottenham Hotspur against Wigan. And what it was that they were like these balls that would rebound off the keeper. The keeper would spill the ball and he would be positioned in the right position to just knock it in. 7 goals is just I don't know. I don't know how you get enough chances in the game to score 7 goals.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't even get 7 shots on goal in a game as a team.
Yeah. And he also had this uncanny knack. Well, this comes with his personality of getting in the opposition's head. So then he would get more opportunities because there would be these mistakes that the defenders would make or the goalkeeper would make. And there was just this fear, this awe. You know, it's kind of like guarding Michael Jordan in game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals or NBA Finals in the mid to late 90s. I mean, mm-hmm. It had that same kind of feel if you were a defender or goalkeeper dealing with Canalia. And like Jordan, he tended to, in the bigger games, just thrive on things. This is why sometimes, and this is an aside, but looking at people's scoring average in basketball is misleading because the great players, the LeBrons and the Jordans and the Larry Birds tended to score more in important games, and they might have scored 12 points in a regular season game mm-hmm. in the middle of December. Canalia was like that. Canalia would score a few goals in April or May early in the season. You know, he lived life large and enjoyed all of the culture and lifestyle around New York. So he wouldn't always start the season well, but then when you got to the business end of the season, look out.
was he, what about the rest of his game? Did it lack? Was he only a goal scorer? Could he play defense? What about the rest of his game?
Yeah, I think this was the frustration that the coaches that managed the Cosmos, Eddie Firmani, especially among them, had with Canalia, was that you were almost playing a man down defensively, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't track back. I mean, the thing he could do is if it was a set piece and the other team had a corner or a free kick, he could mark on set pieces because he was big, but he didn't enjoy it. Yeah, he was a guy that didn't really track back defensively. That's why you see the Cosmos, and there was also other reasons for it. The Cosmos played a lot of 7-4 games, 6-4, 5-3, the kind of score lines that you don't see much in world football. I mean, you're seeing more like the Liverpool game the other day as we're taping this was 5-2 against Roma. So there are some games like that, but the Cosmos regularly were playing in those sorts of games, and part of it was that Canalia didn't defend. Generally, there would be one or two other guys that wouldn't defend on that team. So, mm-hmm. he was just a great goal scorer, didn't play particularly well defensively. But one thing he was able to do when he was feeling in a more team-centric mood was that he was a pretty good passer of the ball, holding the ball up, turning, playing it on to a teammate that's running into the channels, running into space. He didn't do that all the time because he was, he was looking to score himself. But he could play a team game when he needed to.
How was his footwork?
It was good for the era. I mean, I think he could hold the ball down. His first touch was pretty good for that era. It wasn't as good as some of the other Cosmos players. I mean, guys like Ricky Davis, who I think was our first really good American player, him mm-hmm. and Perry Vanderbeck, who played for the Tampa Bay Rowdies, and maybe Kyle Rowe Jr. He had a better first touch, Ricky Davis. And I thought that obviously there were some other attacking players. Carlos Alberto, who played for the Cosmos, Brazilian international, had a great first touch. Canalia's first touch, sometimes he'd be, there'd be a long ball or something played to him where he would have a lead first touch, but generally, his footwork was pretty good, and his movement was deceptively good, because I think there is this image of him as being, and I just went through how he didn't track back and defend well, but he still was able to find pockets of space and would work hard to find those pockets on the attacking end, even though he had the reputation of being kind of just a poacher that feasted on scraps. You don't score a goal a game, which is basically what he did in his career, just by feasting on scraps. You've got to have some talent and some movement and some real individual effort and soccer smarts to do that.
Was he fast? Was he quick?
I would say he was deceptively quick. Now, the thing is that if you played a long ball, let's say over the shoulder to him, and he was in a foot race with a defender, the defender would generally win. Okay, because then you're having to run over 5, 10, 15 yards. With both players knowing where the ball is and what the target is. But I would say his reaction time and instincts were quicker than any of the defenders. So, if the defender was caught off guard, even though Canalia wasn't as fast, he wasn't as pacey as the guy marking him, he generally get to the ball first and slot it home. So I think he wasn't fast or pacey, but his mind was quicker than the defenders, most of the defenders marking him. He could read the game quicker.
You know, the biggest name in the world at that time when it came to soccer, I think was arguably or not arguably Pelé. Cosmos signed him 1 year prior to signing Quinalha. So here you had the world's recognized greatest player and quite possibly the world's greatest goal scorer hooking up to play on the same team. The dynamic, the relationship between the two of them must have been quite something, must have been fragile. How did the team's manager, you mentioned him before, Eddie Firmani, handle the two of them? It must have been quite a challenge.
It was, and I would say that I don't think the relationship was very good. I mean, Pelé was a graceful player who was really good on the ball, was an artist. Canalia was more or less a poacher and was colorful and was a lot about himself. Pelé played I mean, this sounds very stereotypical and maybe lazy analysis. Pelé was more of a team player. Mm-hmm. There were many times where Canalia, and this never happened in Brazil, this never happened in the season in the Cosmos before Canalia arrived, where Canalia had the temerity to tell Pelé, "You're in the wrong position. Pass me the ball. What are you doing?" And Canalia even said years later, look, he was a lovely guy off the pitch, but, you know, on the field we had problems because you serve me, I'll score goals. You know, pass me the ball. I mean, it's just like if you use a basketball analogy, it would be like the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar chastising Magic Johnson, the point guard. You know, Pelé's the number 10 and Canalia is the big guy in the middle, for not passing the ball to him. You know, why are you shooting, type of thing. But I think there were just two supersized egos, and what happened with the coaches of that era are that the coaches of that era were used to managing players who were very submissive. So Eddie Firmani had come from Tampa Bay. He had won a title with the Rowdies, with Rodney Marsh, who was an equally colorful player. He's probably the guy that's the equivalent of Canalia. And I actually saw Marsh last week here in South Florida. He was here for the International Champions Cup announcement. He lives in Tampa still. But Firmani, I think, had a hard time with these guys managing them, and before that, the previous managers all had issues with dealing with Canalia, because I think what you would say, and not just dealing with Canalia, but dealing with the dressing room of the Cosmos players. I mean, even in guys like Stevie Hunt and Beckenbauer when he came, and Carlos Alberto, you had some really Denny Turd and others, some really strong personalities. But it was I think that the managers of that era were not used to dealing with multiple personalities and having to man manage as much as you do today. So that created problems, but there definitely was some tension between Pelé and Canalio.
And the job that Firmani did, I mean, like you just said, you're coming there. These are the best players from around the world. They're not all washed up. It was like an all-star team of the world's best players. How did he mix and match those guys to play as one cohesive unit if they were ever cohesive? Or was it pure talent that won for them?
Well, he did a better job of molding them. I guess you could say than Gordon Bradley, who had preceded him. Gordon Bradley had real problems with Canalia. I mean, couldn't manage Canalia at all. Firmani, Canalia deferred to in some respects after he'd come from Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay had eliminated New York from the playoffs the previous season, Canalia's first year. So there was a certain degree of respect for what the Rowdies had done and what Firmani had done with Tampa Bay. So he was able to kind of keep a peaceful detente between these factions. And, there were some struggles. I mean, they had a real tough time in the 77 playoffs, battle against Fort Lauderdale, who actually had the best, record in the regular season that year. And they got past them. And then against Minnesota, they fell behind, and had to come back in the second leg at Giant Stadium and win 4-0, I think, and to get through. So they had had some struggles before they won the Soccer Bowl. The thing that I think, unfortunately, I mean, I think this is there's a certain degree of blasphemy here when you say this to some Cosmos fans, but the team after Pelé left in 77, after the end of that 77 season when they won that Soccer Bowl that I just referenced, the team was more cohesive the next year because it was very much Canalia's team, right? And there was none of this sort of issue between players. He was the clear leader, even though Beckenbauer was on the team and had won a World Cup, right? And then you had Danny Tuard, a player who had just scored an overhead bicycle kick to win the English League Cup for Manchester City against Newcastle at Wembley, sign. But they were all kind of willing to play by the Canalia rules. And I think there was an established thought process in 1978 and on, if you sign with the Cosmos, you were signing for Canalia's club. Now, prior to that, you were signing for an ambitious club, which Pelé played for, and you know, this Canalia guy, who is he, right? Yeah. Who does he think he is? So I think as time went on, he asserted more and more influence within the playing squad and then eventually with the ownership, the Warner Brothers owners, Steve Ross was his name, and then the Erdogans, who were the founders of Atlantic Records, and had made millions of dollars off of Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin was the biggest act contracted to Atlantic Records. That day, he befriended them and really became a member of the boardroom. By the time it's all said and done, Canalia is sitting there in the same boardroom as the president of Warner Brothers and the president of Atlantic Records. It's crazy when you think about it, but he had assumed that much influence. And I mean, and we've seen historically that happen with top players. They, I'll never forget the story in some, I think it was a documentary on Red Auerbach I watched, where the Celtics players, including, you know, former future Georgetown legendary coach John Thompson, were complaining to Red Auerbach, they're practicing hard, and Bill Russell is in the stands reading the newspaper. And Auerbach says to whoever, I think it was John Thompson, that complained, once you produce like he does, you have the same privilege. And that was the way it was for Canalia.
Did the rest of his teammates get along with him? I mean, the guy was scoring goals and helping them win games.
Yeah, I think they tolerated him. You know, I think it's one of these things where he was so great that they tolerated him, but there was there were certainly some resentments. I mean, it's not it's a lot like some of the views of the professional athletes that had been controversial going forward after that. Did people like being in the same locker room as Barry Bonds? No, they didn't. Did people like being around some of the other greats of that have won championships did they like being in Terrell Owens' locker room? No. but they won, and they won a lot. So I think guys tolerated it, but there was a resentment that you had so many players on the Cosmos who were more accomplished than Canalia at the international level, because Canalia had been kicked off the Italian national team after the 1974 World Cup. You had so many guys who, guys like Carlos Alberto, who had won World Cups, Franz Beckenbauer. You had Niskins, who got the two World Cup finals with the Dutch. He played for the Cosmos. You had all of these guys that were big deals in international football, and they come to New York and they're subservient to a guy who, in at least outwardly, hadn't accomplished as much outside of this club, but it was his club. And he had the ownership's ear. And as I said, he was even in the boardroom.
And his journey to New York, his journey to the NASL, it wasn't a normal journey of a guy saying, you know, that's where I want to go play. He had problems back in Italy. I mean, he was, I believe, terrorist groups threatened him, his family. He had it. Yep. He had problems with the political parties there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, Italy, this is probably why. I mean, I keep getting fielding questions from people on other topics related to current world football. Why has Italy fallen so far off the map? When compared to their league, compared to the English league or the Spanish league or the German league, and why is it that Italy's national team has fallen so far behind those same national teams in Belgium and some of Brazil, some of the other top national teams of the world? The reality is that there has always been this sort of underlying pressure and corruption around Italian football. You know, I don't like to talk about it a lot because it reinforces a lot of the negative stereotypes people have of Italy and of Italians, but there is an unseemly underworld to Italian football that there isn't to English football, for instance, that there isn't to the Premier League. And there were corruption, there were threats, there were also being involved with Lazio. There were some tax issues that Canalia had to deal with. There were also over and over a problem with Canalia's because he had grown up in Wales, there was a feeling that he wasn't really Italian, but he was. And then there, he had an American wife. There were some alleged associations between him and a major crime syndicate, a family crime syndicate whose name escapes me right now, but over money laundering and these sorts of things. Eventually, because of the political situation in Italy, and we're talking about now more recent, prior, he passed away in 2012, lived in Naples, Florida, actually, not far from me, not far from you. He couldn't travel back to Italy the last 5 or 6 years of his life because there had been some sort of attempt by Italian authorities to arrest him and to possibly, because of the corruption of some of these authorities, possibly this is horrible to talk about, but you'd knock him off if he went back to Italy. So he never went back to Italy after 2006. He covered that summer. He was on the World Cup broadcast for ABC and ESPN, and Italy won the World Cup in 2006. And he was celebratory and argumentative with Alexi Lawless and Eric Winalda and the Americans that were on the set. But he never returned to Italy after. He never went to Italy to celebrate that World Cup title. It was that year that all broke down. Now, this had all traced back to his playing career and to the latter stages of his playing career, the alleged associations with this syndicate. So it's unfortunately a very kind of stereotypical story that you hear about Italians and sometimes about Italian Americans because of that. But I tend to, and maybe this is just me being some cognitive dissonance on my part, I tend to try and just put that stuff to the side and not think about it and think about him as a colorful character he was and the great player he was. I don't know what the truth is in any of that. We might never know the truth. He did pass away in 2012, just a few years ago, under this cloud because of all of that.
Do you think his move to the U.S. might have saved his life?
Yeah, quite possibly. And to the point where, again, maybe some of this stuff happened a little later, but the last 6 years of his life, from the time that 2006 World Cup, when Americans probably last saw him prominently on the coverage from ESPN and ABC, until he passed away in early 2012. I remember writing the press release obituary for the new NASL, honoring Giorgio Canali. It was March or April. It was right very around this time, 2012, so 6 years ago. From that point on, I mean, he never went back to Italy because he didn't feel safe.
Mm.
So, yeah, probably did save his life, at least at the end. I mean, he might have died 6 years earlier if he had traveled back to Italy. So, and that's when we became aware of it, right? It probably was simmering for 10, 15, 20 years before that, if not longer.
So we talked about what his personality was like on the field. I mean, it was a strong personality. I read where, you know, a coach called him uncoachable, and he said, that's because I know more than the stupid coaches. Personalities are your personality is formed over the course of your childhood. Did he have a difficult childhood, and did that difficult childhood maybe shape his personality, or that's just who he became?
Yeah, I think it's because his family all had these financial issues right as he was born after World War II and the fall of the fascist regime. And Italy was a basket case, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, right after World War II. And they all lived in, I think they had his family of like six or seven people lived in one room. They moved to Cardiff. That's why he ended up on Swansea. His first club was Swansea City, as I said, or Swansea Town, as it was called then. Because he moves to Cardiff at the age of eight because his family is looking for employment, and they end up in the United Kingdom. And so he's raised in Welsh schools and plays for his first club team is Swansea City or Swansea Town. And that is incredibly difficult in an era when everybody else who played for Swansea would have been English or Welsh. And he was Italian. And then it was incredibly difficult when he goes back to Italy and is playing for Lazio to be the guy that was educated in Welsh schools and speaks English with a Welsh accent and is always in his life was as fluent in English as he was in Italian. That's especially in we outline what Italy was like. So he had a chip on his shoulder because of this. And then he comes to New York. And yeah, he's this signing and scores all these goals, but he's not Pelé. He's not Beckenbauer. He's not Carlos Alberto. He's not Johan Niskanen. He's just a guy, like I said earlier, that had was a good player in these eyes of these people, but he wasn't a global superstar the way they had been. But at the time in his career, he was better than all those guys probably. But still, he always had this chip on his shoulder, and I think he played with it. And his personality reflected that.
Do you think also part of the chip on his shoulder came from the time that he was cut from Swansea? I mean, I think about that.
Yeah.
And I sort of liken that to the high school basketball coach who cut Michael Jordan, who said, this guy just doesn't have what it takes. Well, I think Michael Jordan proved he had what it takes. Now, maybe Kinalia's game wasn't as all around as good a game as Jordan had in basketball, but darn it, if this guy couldn't find the back of the net and win games.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the craziest things. It seems like half the great players in whatever sport on this planet have this story where they were cut by a youth team or cut by a high school team or cut high school coach or cut by their first professional team. And, you know, I even think of Wayne Rooney, the great Wayne Rooney, who Liverpool didn't sign when they had him at a tryout. I mean, there are all these sorts of examples of this, but that also fed into this kind of me against the world mentality that Canalia had, being released by Swansea. He only played six league matches for them. He had come through their youth system. As I said, he basically grown up in Cardiff after the age of eight. So he was Welsh and had come through their youth system, was Welsh enough, but got released. And that did the trick, because he was a guy that had actually scored a ton of goals at the school level, right? At the primary school level, mm-hmm. in Cardiff, which is why Swansea had signed him to their youth academy as an apprentice, as they called it in those days. But then he got released, and he had to go back to Italy, because as an Italian, there was compulsory military service. So the other question is, if Canalia had signed with another English club, another British club, another club in either England or Wales, or maybe even in the Scottish League, after he had been released by Swansea, his career might have been completely different. He might never have gotten to the U.S. because he mm-hmm. would have been fine in England.
Interesting. What about his time at Lazio? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is the kind of controversial. Well, the whole career is controversial, but this is where controversy really began to fall.
But he scored a ton of goals for them.
Yeah, he led Serie A in goal scoring. He won the Golden Boot one year. They almost, in his second season, won Serie A, finishing a point behind Juventus. He led the league in scoring the following year, the 73-74 season. They won the title. So they finished second the previous year, and they won the title. And he was playing incredibly well at the club level, and he was getting called into the Italian national team. They win the title in 74. He's on the World Cup squad in 1974. Doesn't really get the kind of run out that probably he should have. He had been just ignored by the manager. He had to be picked because he had been the leading scorer in the league, and Lazio had won the title. But he got subbed out in the first match against Haiti, and gave a very visceral reaction, and that began the cycle where, okay, he was out of the national team and eventually out of Lazio. And he was, by the end of his time in Lazio, the next season or the next two seasons, fighting with teammates, fighting with coaches, and continuing to score goals. Not at the rate he had in the 73-74 season, when there had been a better team around him and he had won the title. But he was continuing to produce. And then keep in mind, this is a player that had been cut from Swansea. This is a player that had come through Serie C, the third division, in Italy, and had risen to the top and had won the title and led the league in scoring. But once there were question marks, he was never totally accepted by the fraternity of Italian football as one of them. So as we talked about earlier, the end of the 75-76 season, which is the middle of the 1976 NASL season, he comes to New York.
And what did he do for the popularity, if anything, for the NASL and soccer here in the United States?
I mean, he was the draw, right? He was such a draw that Canalia continued on these telecasts of, like what I talked about, 2006 World Cup. They bring Canalia on just for his color and just because everybody knew who he was. If you don't follow American soccer, if you're just a general sports fan and you know the top soccer stars in the world at the time, in 2002, 2006, it would have been guys like Ronaldinho and Rivaldo and Andrei Shevchenko and guys like that. People knew those guys, mm-hmm. and Riquelme, and obviously Messi and Ronaldo after that. You don't really know Alexi Lalas or Eric Winalda or these American guys who would come on the television. So they would always trot Canalia out for big events because he had that colorful personality and that, almost that Charles Barkley-esque feeling from the NBA now, or, what you get with, when you had at the time, John Madden doing NFL, stuff. I mean, obviously I think, there isn't quite an analyst of that that nature. No, Dick Vitale with college basketball. That's the best example. So he would be trotted out just because of that. And he had a great radio voice and radio personality and didn't work with Charlie Stilettano, who's now working for another Stephen Ross. Stephen Ross being the owner of the Miami Dolphins. Charlie Stilettano is running Relevant Sports and the International Champions Cup, which it's going to be huge. As I said, I was at the press conference last week and Rodney Marsh was there in Miami, and they're bringing 18 of the 20 biggest European clubs to the U.S. this summer. All of that started because of Canali and the Cosmos. I mean, you can't deny the legacy. And he continued to be this figure of derision and figure of popularity, you know, depending, you either loved him or hated him. But the point was, he would drive interest. So there were people throughout the country who just went to two NASL games a year, the two times the Cosmos came to town. And if you're in Tulsa or wherever, and you went there so you could boo him and hiss at him and maybe throw things at him. That was the way it was.
Would the Cosmos, they're still relative today. This team hasn't played, at least the original version of the Cosmos, hasn't played in literally decades.
Right.
Colorful, colorful team. Would they have been the Cosmos without Giorgio Chinaglia?
No. I mean, they would have been a team that Pelé played for, and arguably the most famous footballer of all time, a team that Franz Beckenbauer, that Kaiser played for, but he's more associated with Bayern Munich and a German national team. They would have been a club that Carlos Alberto played. No, they wouldn't have been. It wouldn't have had the same effect. There's no question in my mind. Without Canalia, they're just a team that played in New York that had a bunch of stars for a short period of time. The lore and legend of the Cosmos, that continues to this day. I mean, it's incredible the questions I get about the Cosmos, even from fans in Europe, and that era has so much to do with him. The color, the pageantry, the controversy, the attraction, I think, came so much from Canali, and Canali's personality rubbing off on the whole organization and on the fan base.
Yeah, I just don't think that, you know, we could try to describe it. I just don't think that there's really, popularity-wise, color-wise, just the whole band of Cosmos, I don't think there's anything in the MLS that can compare. You said Atlanta's probably as close. I just don't think there's anything that can compare to what the Cosmos were. And no one in the league can come close to what Chinaglia was.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Right. I mean, there was no, in terms of Atlanta, I talked about kind of fan interest and people who want to see a team play, but it's not the same thing. It's a different era. It's tough to get that level of player here now,
right,
because of the Bosman ruling in Europe and the amount of money, the inflated wages teams in Europe are playing. But no, there's nothing quite like it. And there hasn't been an MLS. I mean, the Galaxy tried it for a bit. They tried to go Galactico, but it just didn't have, to pull that off, you have to have some sort of figure with the controversial nature of Canalia. Look, as great as Messi is, he doesn't have the personality to have that kind of following and engender those kind of feelings. So Barcelona, I mean, obviously Neymar kind of is, and that's why he wanted away and went to PSG. There are only so many of those guys who are great enough, are so good, and they can tell you about it and are cocky about it and can infect a club at all levels. And Canalia is one of those guys. I mean, I think throughout sports, there are only a handful of those guys that are also outspoken and cocky. And, John McEnroe was one, right? Although McEnroe, that's what people say now about tennis. The problem is Federer and Nadal and Djokovic. They're too nice, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have anyone quite like that. In golf, even the major champions are all these kind of, they're choir boys by comparison.
Vanilla. I mean, they're all vanilla.
Right. Yeah. So this is why Canalia to this day remains just this larger than life figure. And he always will be, as far as a lot of American soccer fans are concerned, because you just don't get guys like that. That's why Zlatan who signed with the Galaxy now. Now, unfortunately, he signed at 36 with the Galaxy, but Zlatan has been such a phenomenon in Europe because he has got that same sort of cocky personality. Now he's in the City of Stars, but unfortunately, he's 36. But again, I mean, he showed that in Italy and in England throughout his and Paris, PSG throughout his career. He'd be the closest thing today to Zlatan, to Canalia.
And the amazing thing about Canalia is it all happened here. What was he a? You know, we talked about his personality on the field and the problems and what kind of player he was. Was he a good guy?
Yeah, I tend to think he probably was. You don't get a lot of positive opinions about him from people who knew him, who played with him, or were around the cosmos, just because I think there was a certain degree of resentment and that there was all these other things going on. But I get the impression that he might have been a kind person and a very considerate person to those who were around him, including those who were handlers of him, like Pepe Pinto, who eventually ended up owning the Cosmos name. He took care of those who took care of him.
What do you think his legacy became in Italy?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think that there, again, like I said, he couldn't go back there at the end of his life, or felt like he didn't feel safe going back there at the end of his life. I think his legacy in Italy was of this controversial guy that was colorful, but he was selfish, arrogant, not a team player. And that's the way Italians, I mean, the thing about Italian football, and now they're falling further and further behind the rest of Europe. The thing about Italian football is a very kind of tactical team game that doesn't encourage individual player the way Spanish football does, the way football in Latin America does, the way even at times the English game does encourage some individual creativity and flair. The Italian game is very regimented tactics. You know, we're playing three at the back, two wing backs, you're in position, keep the shape, that sort of thing. So I almost think if Canalia had been Spanish or had been Brazilian or Argentine, he would have been less controversial. But because he was Italian, and it's something that people view with derision towards Italian football, they're very, very regimented. It's like playing in that system in any sport. You know, you talk about like systems in let's say American football, where it's a pro style offense. You're going to pound the ball forward and you're going to try and win games 10-3, 13-10, that kind of thing. Italian football is very much about getting the goal and sitting back and absorbing pressure and winning 1-0. Whereas the game in England, as people see every week in the Premier League, is about a pace and speed and all of these other factors that lead to these 4-2 and 5-3 results in that league all the time. So Canalia just didn't fit in there. So his legacy in Italy is one of he's looked down upon and seen as arrogant and selfish, but it's also part of their football culture, which is which doesn't lend itself to creativity and flair. So I have some sympathy for him in that.
Would you say, you were talking about systems, and one thing I wanted to ask, did the Cosmos develop a system for Canalia to work in and develop that system while he was there, or did he have to fit into the Cosmos system?
No, I think what Eddie Firmani did is, okay, so at first he had to fit into the Cosmos system with Gordon Bradley, and maybe initially with Firmani, but eventually it became a system where he's the number nine, he's sitting in the middle of the pitch, higher up than everybody, you play through him, and you play to him. That wasn't the case in 76 when Pelé was there and Gordon Bradley was the manager. That wasn't the case in the early stages of 77 and while Pelé was still there. When Denny Kuehr came the next year and Ricky Davis began to develop, you began to get this very regimented, well, it wasn't really regimented, but more or less you play through Canalia and you look for him. You look for balls to him over the shoulder. If you get a free kick or corner, you're looking for him as the target, or you're putting the ball in his direction and you're letting him go find the ball and put the ball in the back of the net. So yeah, the system was very much eventually built around him.
What do you tell people about Giorgio Canalia when they ask you about him?
that he was controversial. He was fun, but he was fun to watch. He was controversial, and he was worth the price of admission times 10. I mean, we just don't have guys. We just don't make guys like him anymore.
And in the end, how should we remember Giorgio Chinaglia?
As the greatest goal scorer in American domestic club soccer in the history of the sport in this country, and the guy who really showed the American public how colorful and how much personality you could have as an international soccer player coming to this country. And I think he had so much to do with the growth and popularity of the game today. I mean, the number of players that began to play youth soccer because they saw Canalia score goals then fueled the youth soccer boom in the late 70s and 1980s that then led to the U.S. having a good national team until recently for about 20 years and qualifying for all these international tournaments. It was on the backs of people seeing there was a revisionism that gives Pelé a lot of the credit and Rodney Marsh and some of the names that came to the NASL, but it was Canalia scoring goals because that's what kids want to do when you're sure. When you're a kid, you're not dreaming of being like the guy who passes the ball. You're not dreaming of being John Stockton. You want to be Karl Malone. Right. So it developed a culture of that sort of thing where guys developed and they wanted to play soccer, and eventually they ended up playing defensive positions or midfield positions, but they wanted to play because they saw Canalia score goals and celebrate. His celebrations after goals was part of what attracted kids, which again is something that in sports at that time was looked down upon. You know, you would score a goal and you walk away. You score a touchdown and you hand the ball to the referee. You score a basket and you just go back on defense, right? That was the way it was. And then you had in New York at the time, Reggie Jackson hitting home runs in 1977 for the Yankees and celebrating those home runs. And then Canalia scoring these goals and then dancing and running to the crowd and playing to the crowd. Totally different type of sport personality than we had seen in the past.
Yeah, I had a question for you, and I wasn't sure I was going to ask it, but I'm going to ask it now because you referenced it. Did he help the popularity of soccer? Did he help grow soccer here in the United States?
Oh, there's no question about that in my mind. It is not even debatable to me. Now, there are people who will debate it with me, but to me, it's not debatable. He was the guy who scored goals. He was the guy who celebrated after goals. He was the guy who made it look fun. And he's the guy who inspired tons of kids to play. And even those who hated the Cosmos would want to play in pickup games when they were 6 or 7 years old and be the guy who marked Canalia, right? So there's no question. I mean, it seems like blasphemy to put him on a pedestal above Pelé in some regards. And it's just very politically incorrect. But I think in some regards, he was more important than Pelé to growing the game in this country.
That's awesome. That's saying a lot. Hey, Kartik, thank you so much for being here on Sports Forgotten Heroes. Like we did the last time, tell people how they can hear you every week.
Yeah, so check us out at worldsoccertalk.com. We've got a weekly podcast where we talk more about media these days than soccer. A lot of talk about Fox Sports now and their upcoming coverage of the World Cup, and Turner Sports picks up UEFA Champions League next year, including, this might be of interest to some of your listeners, Steve Nash, who of course is talking about point guards, great basketball point guard, is going to be actually on Turner's soccer coverage.
Wow.
Because he comes from a soccer family. Everybody else in his family, his father played professional soccer, his brother is a professional soccer player I worked with, actually, Martin Nash, and Steve himself is a massive soccer fan. So he's going to be working for Turner Sports, but we cover the media every week, and we obviously talk a little bit of soccer and tactics and stuff too. So worldsoccertalk.com, and I'm at Twitter at KKFLA737.
Awesome, Kartik. Thank you again so much for being here, and I can't wait till we do it again next time.
Yeah, thank you.
When you add it all up, Giorgio Chinaglia just might be the greatest goal scorer in the history of soccer. The guy just knew how to put the ball in the net. In a career that started in 1964 for Swansea and ended in 1983 with the Cosmos, and not including national team or indoor games, he scored 321 goals in 525 games, averaging nearly a goal a game for the Cosmos by scoring 193 times in just 213 games. But as good as he was at scoring, as Kartik pointed out, he wasn't so good defending. But playing defense wasn't what he was paid for. I think it would have been really interesting to see how he would have fared in today's MLS. Would his style have been accepted? Not sure, but speed translates from generation to generation, and so does desire. And his desire to be the best goal scorer was undeniable. He turned an entire generation into soccer fans with his exploits on the field. And while there was some shady stuff to what he did off the field back in Italy, here in the U.S., he never got in trouble, and after his untimely death in 2012, his family, led by his wife Connie, who, by the way, is the sister of U.S. Olympic hockey legend Mike Ruzioni, established the Giorgio Canaglia Foundation to help children in need. Giorgio Canaglia, one of a kind. Next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to explore the career of a past U.S. Open golf champion, a man whose name is rarely brought up despite the fact that he won 16 times on tour, including back-to-back U.S. Open championships, Ralph Guldal. Thanks again to my guest today, Kartik Krishnayer, and we'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the Official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the Official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.